Kathleen Rooney is in the studio with me, Rick Kogan, on this show After Hours. She is fresh from writing, which is a great thing, fresh from writing poetry on State Street. She is one of the most talented poets around and an astonishingly talented novelist. We'll talk about all of that. You're just fresh from State Street, aren't you?
Yeah, we were at Sundays on State with our typewriters, and we wrote 68 poems on demand for people, and it was a lot of fun.
Tell me how that works and how that Poems While You Wait was born.
Yes, so it was born in 2011 in Chicago when my friend Dave Landsberger and my friend Eric Plattner and I decided to do this thing that Dave had done back in Miami where he was in graduate school, where you just set up on the street, you put out your typewriter, you put out a sign-up sheet, and people give you their name, a topic, and a suggested donation, and then they go wander away for a little bit, and then when they come back in 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, you have a poem on that topic. And today, for instance, we wrote poems about cheese. We wrote poems about Chicago in the rain. We wrote poems about first year of college.
So topical.
I know.
Topical.
And we wrote like a dozen love poems, which I never get sick of.
People come up and say, I want a love poem.
Yes. And sometimes that's all they say. And other times they say, it's my girlfriend. Her name's Selma. She loves to garden. So we can work with anything.
Do you write it individually or do you collaboratively?
Both. Usually it's individual. It's kind of a, you know, first come, first serve. You put your name on the list and we sort of tag team, like whoever's free just like grabs the list, grabs the topic, whether they want the topic or know anything about it. If it's slower, we'll collab. It'll be like a Benihana situation where we're like throwing the typewriters back and forth.
What's an average donation, Kathleen Rooney?
Yeah, we ask for, we suggest 10. That's our donation. All the money goes to Rose Metal Press, which is a 501c3 literary nonprofit that puts out books that I co-run. But it's interesting. A lot of times people tip above and beyond.
Oh, I'm sure they
we've
do.
Gotten, I think the highest we've gotten for a single poem so far is $100.
Well,
so people are generous.
And they say that poets don't make money.
I know.
It's a challenging thing, is it not for you?
Yeah, it's I think that's why many of us like to do it, is it gets us out of our typical wheelhouses, and you have to write about something whether you're in the mood or not.
Well, one of the things I want to talk to you about, your latest book is Where Are the Snows? It is a prize-winning book published by the University of Texas? Where is it?
Yeah, Texas Review Press.
Texas Review Press. And this collection was selected from, I've got to think, hundreds of other selections?
Yes. It's a big honor. It's I'll do a plug for the prize in case there's any poets listening. It's a $10,000 annual prize. It's the X.J. Kennedy Prize, named after the great poet X.J. Kennedy, who's in his 90s but is still alive and kicking. And yeah, if you win it, the contest judge will write you a nice blurb and they'll pay you the money and put out. I mean, it's radio, so you can't see, but the book is gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful job.
No, it really is beautiful. How does one balance? I know that writers throughout history have balanced writing poetry and novels and poetry and nonfiction. What is the balance for you?
Oh, that's a great question.
In your literary life, what came first?
Poetry. Poetry came first. My parents, shout out to my parents who I think are at a wedding now, but will listen later to the archived version. They always had books in the house, but to their credit, they didn't skip poetry. I think a lot of people are intimidated by poetry.
No question.
My parents were like, read poetry.
Wow. I think they're intimidated in large part because of the way poetry has traditionally been taught.
Yes.
Memorize this. Here's a Shakespeare sonnet. Not that Shakespeare is any slouch poet. Here's a Shakespeare sonnet. Memorize this.
Yep.
And without any understanding. That's great. When did you write your first poem then, as a child?
Yeah, as a kid. A story that I like to tell because I think it speaks to how much I wanted to be a writer and how supportive my parents were, is that before I could write, like before I even was literate, I was writing quote-unquote poems, and so my mom got a tape recorder, child of the 80s, and recorded me reciting my little poems and telling my little stories because she wanted to help me document it.
And how empowering was that?
It was amazing. Yeah,
I'll bet. So how do you split time now? We'll talk about your upcoming novel because it's very timely and concerns someone I knew, for goodness sake. And your other one about a pigeon.
Yes.
I'm calling it the pigeon novel, that is one of the best things I've read in as long as I can remember. I raved about it before. You people out there can go back and go in the archives and find the interview. I just raved about it. How do you balance that? You also teach.
Yeah. I like to be busy. I'm one of these people who, when you have nothing to do, you do nothing. So for me, a busy schedule, like the more I do, the more I do. But I will say, honestly, when I'm writing a novel like, you know, Cher Ami, which you were mm-hmm. an amazing interview on, or Lillian Boxfish, that's all I can do. Like, aside from, I can do the poems while you wait, but my head is fully in that world.
God, can you do the poems while you wait while you're working on a novel?
Yes, I can. And I like that because it gives me breaks. But when I'm writing my own poetry, like in Where Are the Snows, I have to kind of be between projects.
I can only imagine. I'm going to read one of the, how many are in here? 20, 30.
Yeah, there's 39.
39 poems in here, and they are all delightful and incisive and about life, but they're also a great deal of fun, too. We'll carry on with Kathleen Rooney, who you can find at KathleenRooney.com. We'll be back. Kathleen Rooney just told me off air that the poems in Where Are the Snows, her prize-winning collection, were written in a, I don't want to call it a frenzy, but in a pandemic time of April 2020. Did you just say to yourself, I need to write some poems? Is that how?
Yeah, great question. Credit where it's due. My friend Kimberly Southwick, another great poet, runs an annual poem a day group in April. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge people give themselves.
Poetry month.
For years I'd said no, and that year she asked if I wanted to do it, and I didn't know it was going to be a pandemic, but I said, yeah, I think I can make time, and I didn't realize how much time we would all have.
Was it challenging?
It was, but it was good. I will say that, I mean, it literally got me out of bed in the morning.
I'm going to read one, and then I want to hear from you about the inspiration for this one. It's titled Pastoral. Lake Michigan churns like a washing machine today. Buckets of rain mean I remain indoors. The distant thunder of the toilet flushing. The sky out the window, a moody adolescent. When was the last time I just sat by a tree? Why do the woods have a neck anyway? A week past the vernal equinox, it stays too cold for green buds or bugs. When it comes to alcohol and cookies, why are grasshoppers minty? Convallis is a gnarly name, gnarly for me, for morning glory. Ranculca, same, but for buttercups. In Chicago, we call plastic bags blowing across the sidewalk jewel tumbleweeds. The wind runs up the street on invisible feet. Its breath is the shepherd, the debris, its sheep. There won't be any sunset to speak of today, but all it would have is Et un Arcadia ego. Canadian geese make a V in the sky, a reminder that in the end, victory shall be theirs. Stare too long at a screen and the heart grows pathetic, misanthropic hamster jogging on a wheel. Can idle merriment nymphs and swains ever attain on purpose what nature achieves spontaneously? When I can't visit nature, nature visits me, the fattest sparrow on the bare ash tree. That's really a lovely poem. There's a lot going on in there. Can I ask what inspired that poem?
Yeah.
Looking out the window?
Yeah, literally looking out the window. I mean, I don't want to say it's just like a pandemic collection, but it was written then, and I feel like it reflects that sort of like claustrophobic feeling of the times and trying to make the most of whatever is in your immediate orbit. And I mean, even the ash tree, probably tree lovers know, like all throughout Chicago, the emerald ash borer is killing all the ash trees. So, yeah. You know, there used to be an ash tree just dead outside my window. So I wrote about it.
When you write poetry, when you write a poem like that, I think there's a feeling, a general misconception on the part of the public that a poem comes to one fully formed. That cannot possibly be the case. It can't be, well, yeah, okay, wrote that, that's done, file it away.
No, it's a process. And I would say for me, it's kind of like I'm always writing a poem. I'm a notebook keeper. Joan Didion has that great essay on keeping a notebook where she says people who keep notebooks are magpies. And, you know, if you're a bird fan, you know, magpies are famous for supposedly picking up, you know, various little shiny things and trash for their nests or just saving it for later. And so I keep a notebook that way where even if it seems like its purpose is mysterious, I'll throw it in. And then when I sit down to write a poem, it's a combination of a present inspiration mixed with some of that past collecting that
and
I've done.
You revise, of course.
I do. Yeah, I'm a big fan of time. I, you know, as much as I love Poems While You Wait, where there is no revision, I consider that its own genre. It's like jazz or improv.
Sure.
But for a solo poem, I'm a huge fan of almost like waiting until you're a different person, like till your future self, who is a different person than the self that wrote the poems, can come back and kind of fix what your past self did. So I waited like 7 months before I revised these.
By fix, I'm taken with that word. By fix, what do you mean?
I think, you know, like there's Wordsworth's kind of, you know, spontaneous emotion recollected in quiet tranquility. And so I think the spontaneous emotion is great, whatever the impulse, whatever got you stoked to sit down and type up your poem. But sometimes it has an overmuchness. Sometimes you just need to turn it down. Like it's not like when everything's up to 11, it becomes its own kind of monotony. So you want to, you know, modulate.
Tell me about the difference in the energy involved in writing poems and writing fiction. Poems, in essence, are fiction, but in a book, do you set a sort of schedule for yourself in working on a novel, for instance?
Yeah, what's so funny is with the poetry, I had a set schedule. Like every morning, it was the first thing I would do, you know, after like getting up, brushing my teeth, meditating, doing some light calisthenics. It would be like into the document and I would be done by lunchtime. So poetry for me lately has been more scheduled. And I think that's because poetry is a sprint where to me, I just like run as fast as I can. And a novel is an absolute marathon.
Well, it's an absolute marathon for you because I'm going to talk about Cherami and Major Whittlesey. There's so much research involved in that book. Tell the potential readers out there again how that book was born. I was fascinated with the birth of that book.
Yeah, so Cherami and Major Whittlesey, the you know title characters are who it's about. One is a pigeon and one is a soldier. It's a World War One story based on a true story. And I had a student, maybe he's listening, Brian Michich. I teach at DePaul, and he mentioned Cherami in a poem he wrote for my class and said, look it up, because I'm always telling my students to look things up.
Give me an A and look it up.
So look it up. I did the assignment. Brian told me to look it up, and I found all about Cherami, who's this little pigeon. I'll say to the readers, look it up. She's stuffed. She's in the Smithsonian, and she saved a group of soldiers called the Lost Battalion. And I knew as soon as I looked it up that I had to write about her.
One of the hallmarks of that book and one of the most powerful things about that novel is the voice of the pigeon. I'm sure people out there are going, wait, a pigeon can't talk. What? How could she do a pigeon? How difficult was that for you? Or did it come to you? Was it a kind of organic thing?
Yeah.
Was it your initial idea to do that? Was it?
Yeah, I knew right away because the two characters are so inextricably intertwined in this historical event that I had to hear from both of them. And I think, I don't know. What's interesting to me, I think a lot of artists retain a certain connection to a childlike state. And when you're a child, you read so many books, like Charlotte's Web is the big example, that are about animals. And
right.
You hear from animals, and animals have
an
personalities.
Animal farm, I mean.
Yeah, and voices. And so it wasn't that weird to me. I have a lot of readers I know. It's hard. I know a lot of people don't like pigeons. I know there's the whole rats with wings. But they're not. They're amazing. And so I encourage people to get
to
impressed by pigeons.
To learn more, and you will learn to appreciate. That book was stunning to me. And it did well in this weird publishing environment, did it not?
Yeah. It seemed like it found its readers. I still hear from people. It came out almost exactly 2 years ago, and we were reminiscing off air. I did this show, and now I'm in the studio. Again, it's radio, you can't see, but we did that interview. I was on my sad little cell phone in my kitchen because we were still isolating. So, it's fun to put a book out now into a world where we can actually see people again.
Now, do you expect to do some signings and talking about this collection? Do you not?
I do. In fact, if people are interested, I will be at the Bookseller in Lincoln Square.
Bookstore.
Yeah, Wednesday the 21st at 7 p.m. With two other local writers, Timothy Moore and Jessica Ann. And then about a week after that, on Thursday the 29th, I will be at Pilsen Community Books with the wonderful poet Ananda Lima.
You can get all this kind of information at KathleenRooney.com, and you can also buy her books there. I want to talk, after I'm keeping you for a few more minutes, through the news about certently about your teaching. And you also do book reviewing, and you have a wonderful literary, I think, juggling act going on here. You want it that way, do you not?
Yeah. I want to be like a person of letters. It's the thing I love most of all, so I feel very grateful that I'm able to, like, Tetris in all the different little pieces.
And you live with a writer.
Yes. Shout out to my spouse, Martin C. His book is The Mirror Thief. I am biased, but I think it's fabulous. If you want a big, old, 600-page sort of literary thriller, he's your man.
I just gave Brett a 550-page book, Heat 2 by Michael Mann, and he collaborated with someone. You teach at DePaul. How long have you been doing that?
I started at DePaul in 2010, so it's been, I know, it's been a long time. And it feels weird because I passed my 10-year anniversary of teaching during the pandemic, so it almost felt like it didn't happen. But we're starting at DePaul on the 7th, so on Wednesday.
In person.
Yeah, I love teaching. It's like the first poem in this collection is called Dress Up,
I love
to dress up, and kind of teaching to me is a performance in the best possible way. I just want people to be entertained and educated, so I can't wait to get back to the show.
What do you teach?
It's a good representation. Creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
We do all the genres. I do English 101, which is a class that I call Ladies Night, and ladies is in quotes because we interrogate what it means to be a lady, and we read all the major texts are by women, just to think about the canon. And then I teach a class this quarter called Writing the Body, where we do any kind of writing, anything having to do with the body, like sports, sex, drugs, illness, anything.
Sounds like something I should take. We will be back after the news and talk a little bit more. I want to talk about the Chicago literary community because you are an active act. You and Martin are active players in that. So I hope you stay tuned. You might, while you're listening to the news, go to KathleenRooney.com and learn more about her. Otherwise, just lay back, have a drink, and stay tuned. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Kathleen Rooney at the very end of her wonderful prize-winning poetry collection, Where Are the Snows, from which I read, and which has terrific, wonderful, playful cover, sort of the road to hell is on the cover. You thank a number of people here, thanks as well to the city of Chicago and the generosity of its literary community. You are not from Chicago. You have been here for some time. You certainly know literary communities around the country. Chicago's is rich, nurturing, and every other thing it should be, is it not?
Yeah, it's a very hospitable place to be a writer. I think it has all of the excitement and diversity of, like, an even bigger city or, like an international city, which it is, of course, but it's so livable. And I think for me as a writer, I need that balance. Like, I would, I think, really struggle in a city like LA or New York or even Washington, D.C., where I've lived, which are industry towns. And I think there's just something here where it's, I don't know, a friend of mine put it once, more of a community, less of an economy. So people are really interested in people and not just, making money or making a name for themselves. And I think that makes a difference.
Well, it is inordinately supportive, as well as having a number of great independent bookstores too, which is the lifeblood, I think.
Yes.
Of the publishing scene.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Bill Savage, who we were kind of talking about off the air too, talks about sort of like this concept of literary infrastructure. And if you're on Twitter, you see Bill and a bunch of us do this thing called Manhole Cover Monday, where we tweet pictures of manholes because we love infrastructure, literal infrastructure. Like, we live by Lake Michigan, but if we didn't have a system that got it to us and that got the dirty water away from us, what good would Lake Michigan be? And I think to your point about the bookstores, and what I love about the Chicago community is not only is it a great place for writers to sit quietly and thrive and, you know, be able to live while they make their work, then when they're ready to get it out into the world, there's all these people, formally and informally, you know, who support you, from, you know, the booksellers to the book reviewers to, you know, the bookstagrammers. Like, so many of my students now do like TikTok books, they're book talkers. So there's just this real infrastructure of people who want to like help tell the world about your book once it's out.
As a teacher, what do you think of the voice, and it's a very stupid question in a way, but the collective voice of the upcoming generation, those kids who are in creative writing classes at DePaul?
Yeah, so they're technically Gen Z now. They're Zoomers. You know, all of my students, with I think very few exceptions, were born after 2000, which is
frightening.
Bonkers.
Yeah.
And I think they're really smart, and I think they're really funny. I think their voice is, I would say, self-aware and not afraid of the darkness that so many of us are facing in the world.
Yeah.
But they also seem to want to have a good time on the page, which I think is
Well, it'd be very great. Interesting, I think, for you doing face-to-face classes starting when? This week, Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday. I can't wait to meet them. I don't know what the vibe's going to be, but I'll report back.